free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. See our upcoming speakers in the past lineup, as well as download our past shows. And you can get some call-in numbers if you happen to be calling or listening to this program live. We do ask that you wait till the end of the show to call in, see what, help us cover any questions that maybe we haven't covered. Our guest today, April 7, 2008, is Wes Bolsland. He is Chief Marketing Officer and Vice President at Coscata, a solar company. Actually, I'm sorry. For some reason, I'm thinking you're solar, but you're doing
no,
ethanol.
More biofuels on the biofuel side, trying to make next generation ethanol. So thank
right.
you for having me on today.
Garbage and old tires, tubes packed with bundles of white fibers are core of a bioreactor, which is the heart of the new technology. It combines thermochemical and biological approaches to make ethanol out of wood chips, household garbage, grass, and old tires, just about any organic material. Well, Wes, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here today, and looking forward to talking to you about what Coscata is doing today.
Well, let's... First of all, kind of give us an overview as to how this technology works and what it is that you have.
Well, really what it is, it breaks down to a pretty simple three-step process. The first step is called gasification, and that's really what allows us the material flexibility, like you talked about, tires or trash or new energy crops or, you know, leftover agricultural residues. We can take any of those carbon-based materials in, and you turn them into the base gases of carbon monoxide and hydrogen that are microorganisms. In our, you know, kind of the second step of the process is these gases, that synthesis gas, it's called, goes into a biological reactor that we have proprietary Coscata microorganisms that consume this synthesis gas and produce ethanol. So it's a mix between a biological process and a kind of a biochemical process where it, the production is only ethanol. We then separate it out into fuel-grade quality that can then go in the vehicle. And the great part is that you know, our production costs are under $1 a gallon for doing this.
So the ethanol is coming out at $1 a gallon for
yeah,
the purchaser?
Yeah, so that, I mean, that includes, you know, kind of everything except if you will, capital recovery. You're really not sure how, if you're integrating with a pulp and paper mill or a, you know, kind of a current corn ethanol facility to make it even more efficient, you know, capital recovery is different than if you're building a plant out in the middle of Nebraska or Wyoming or something. So really we're looking at marginal cost or production cost of less than $1 a gallon of ethanol.
Yeah, and you're producing that from basically garbage, that garbage in, ethanol out.
Yeah, it's not quite Mr. Fusion, you know, like in Back to the Future, but it really is seeking out that organic content, that carbon content that's contained in trash. And there's really no reason for putting it in a hole in the ground when you can turn it back into a renewable biofuel like ethanol.
Now, I know over the weekend, there were quite a few stories around the planet that were brought to my attention regarding this situation with ethanol, where people are, you know, corn, for example, being used for ethanol is driving up the price of corn, driving up the prices of food, aggravating this slouch that the U.S. and the world is in economically, the economic depression, so to speak. One of the driving factors is ethanol, of all things. And so your approach doesn't involve the food chain. It it goes to the waste stream.
Right. We're using non-food-based sources. It doesn't even have to be waste. A big opportunity is some of these new energy crops, some of the cellulosic content that's left after agricultural waste. So you have a sugar mill, for example, and you take sugar cane. The leftover material that didn't make sugar is called bagasse. That is a wonderful input, as well as, but these are agricultural waste that's really, you know, you could be just turning these into fuel and reducing our dependence on oil using non-food-based sources. And that's where, as you said, the corn ethanol debate, you know, people get frustrated that, you know, using food for fuel. I don't see it has to be a food versus fuel. I think you can do food and fuel. But, you know, really what we're taking an approach, Coscata is taking an approach to look at non-food-based sources for the production of biofuels.
When you talk about microorganisms, you're talking about a time process. What is the turnaround time for the in-to-out turnover?
That's the great part of the story. We're looking at a continuous process, not a batch process. It's not like making a big beer vat or something. We're looking at a continuous flow from the time that material enters this gasifier until the time ethanol comes out the back end. You're looking at something as little as 2 minutes for the production of ethanol, which is just, kind of mind-blowing in some senses that you could put a ton of material in the front end and have ethanol coming out the back end in just a couple minutes.
So your microorganisms, it's not dependent on microorganisms replicating, but the microorganisms are serving as the workhorse?
Absolutely. These are these organisms, it's just like we breathe in air. They're breathing in this synthesis gas, carbon monoxide, hydrogen, and these workhorses, as you call them, microorganisms, and then they sweat out ethanol as they're working, is the one way of thinking of it. They're taking in a gas, carbon monoxide, hydrogen, which they co-metabolize, and they are excreting ethanol, a liquid. And so it's a very efficient biological process for a gas to liquid transfer.
When you use the word syngas, my understanding is that the gasification process involves some kind of intense heat, an arc or something along those lines. What do you use in your situation?
Yeah, gasification is simply a process that breaks down whatever material into its organic components. You know, most of the material of life, you look at a tree or you look at a switchgrass that the president talks about, it's contained mostly carbon monoxide, hydrogen, carbon dioxide, maybe a little bit of sulfur. It's a woody substance, but it's most of the materials of life that, you know, grow based on photosynthesis have a pretty similar content, and all you're doing is breaking it back down into its organic components, and that is called synthesis gas. It's also been known as town gas before. It's what ran through a bunch of the lighting back when you had a lamp, burning pieces along the street.
Now, when you're describing this carbon-based input, would you say that your system is most closely aligned with the biomass field?
It's really an integration change. You have a chain of people that have a resource. Say it's woody biomass, say it's trash, or new energy crops. There's people on the front end that Coscata is not developing that. But in the middle, you have Coscata as the conversion technology, converting this biomass into a liquid fuel. And then we tie in well with the back end, with the distribution. When we can make ethanol anywhere across the United States, it really makes a big difference. You're not pipelining it from Illinois or Indiana or Iowa, out to the coast anymore. You're using material that is available, locally available, to make this ethanol. And so we're aligned in the middle of the industry, if you will, as we hope to be, the premier conversion technology globally for carbon-based material going into biofuels.
Now, there's a when we talk about waste to energy and biomass, there of course is an unending stream of supply in modern civilization, and there are a lot of companies who are tackling that sector. How far along are you in the process of implementation? Are you early prototype stage? Do you have commercial units out in operation? Where are you at?
Yeah, we're entering the commercialization stage. So we have a pilot facility tied to our headquarters just outside of Chicago, Illinois. We have already started building a commercial demonstration plant, which we will open up in approximately 12 months. And we are looking at, breaking ground on our first 50 to 100 million gallon facility in the next, coming months, we'll say, in coming months. So we're not waiting on any invention. We're not hoping something, we have a big breakthrough. We're really in the commercialization process. A technology that's able to make biofuels under $1 a gallon, reducing greenhouse gas emissions by as much as 80%. It really takes away some of those big negatives that people have talked about, ethanol. Mostly when they talk about all these negatives, they're thinking about it from a corn basis, whereas from a cellulosic kind of next-generation ethanol perspective, you really have a lot of opportunity.
How would a cellulosic inflow work in your system?
So we take the entire plant. So we're not trying to separate out just the cellulose or the sugars, which is where a lot of the enzymatic approaches are really focused on pulling that sugar out of that biomass. We're taking the entire plant. So think of it as the whole tree, the whole piece, if you will, going in, the lignin, the cellulose, the hemicellulose, all those products. And that's why we can make more than 100 gallons of fuel from 1 ton of dry material. And so that's an interesting piece of, we're taking in, we'd like to sort out the inorganic content of trash, for example. Let's recycle the metals, the aluminum, the glass. If it gets really hot and it melts, it doesn't really help us. What we need is organic material. When you decompose it, turns back into its elements of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. It's essentially just a big conveyor belt, some senses, going into this very hot zone, a hot temperature zone, that breaks apart the material into its chemical elements.
Uh-huh. Now, when you're talking about a waste stream, let's say municipal waste, for example, only a certain proportion of that waste is going to be the carbon base that you're talking about. Are you looking at a conveyor system that would separate out, let's say, municipal waste on the front end, or are you looking at pre-sorting on the consumer end where they're putting things out on the curb in one bin for you guys, another bin for the landfill?
Yeah, we've got what we're looking at is a true partnership model. I mean, Europe is much better with separating out waste than really the U.S. right now. In some ways, they hand sort the waste over in Europe because they have such high what they call tipping fees. In the U.S., we're looking at a true partnership model. If Coscata was trying to figure out all of this on our own, we'd probably have some difficulties. What we're looking at is partnering with some of the largest waste players in the country that know how to handle their material. They've been handling it for many years. There are technologies which help sort out what I'm calling the carbonaceous material, the organic material, and get rid of the inorganics, the metals, the glass, the aluminum, etc. And so there is a sorting technology where you wouldn't per se do it at your curbside, because that just becomes difficult for additional truck runs of the waste hauling industry. But what you would do is probably sort it on the back end, is really where people are talking about.
you'd have some kind of automated system, like a belt system that would use magnets to pull out the metals and et cetera.
Exactly. Large magnets and pieces like that separate out the metals very easy. And then you may want to even sort out some of the banana peel. We can turn them in, but, you know, to ethanol too. But there's actually some value to having watermelon rinds and banana peels and things going back into the ground and providing, you know, the good stuff, if you will, back to the earth. And so really this is a focus on doing things more environmentally conscious as well as, you know, making fuel instead of putting it into holes in the ground that then let methane gas go into the air. So we really will be partnering with, I mean, you can imagine the big players, the Allied Waste, the Waste Management, the Violas of the world, know how to handle their material, know how to separate their material. And that's what I say is Coscata wants to be the conversion technology. We want to be the best producer of biofuels in the world from whatever material comes in that front end.
I know there's another company up in Washington State that has a technology similar to yours, and they're also going to commercial stage where they've got their models. They're maybe 6 to 9 months ahead of you in that regard. And they actually, it's a very similar process, and what comes out the other end in their case is high-grade diesel.
Okay. It has a Fischer, is it called like a Fischer-Tropsch process where they do it through a chemical catalyst maybe?
Yeah, it's a chemical catalyst process.
Yeah, that's exactly what, you know, what they've been doing that for quite a few years. So.
Yeah. But they, it sounds like an interesting, I mean, we need both fuels. We need diesel for some kinds of vehicles. We need ethanol for other kinds. It's a different customer base. And it seems like the two of you ought to be, or the two, not necessarily the two companies in particular, but the one that I'm thinking of, but the two industries ought to be working in league so that at any given location, you're not just producing ethanol or you're not just producing diesel, but you can actually have some of both. So when I pull up to my gas station, I've got an option between diesel and then the three grades of gasoline.
Absolutely. No, and that's there's so many opportunities as we enter this path. I mean, there's a lot of similarities on this front-end gasification. In fact, I'm not sure if your listeners know that General Motors took an ownership stake into Coscata. It's the first time they've really pushed into this area, investing an undisclosed amount of money into Coscata, believing it would be the future of biofuels. It also has potential to, you know, put some hydrogen, as the hydrogen economy grows out there, off this gasification process. As you say, you could run syngas, synthesis gas off of a gas fire, and through a catalyst approach if people choose that to make diesel. There's so many opportunities, and I'm really excited about where biodiesel, bioethanol, and et cetera are going.
The company I'm thinking of is called Green Power Inc.
Yeah, I mean there's a few companies, especially I've heard a good bit about some of these. There's a number of people that have been doing Fischer-Tropsch or a chemical catalysis approach. High temperature, high pressure, pushing it through a catalyst bed. Coscata is using low temperature, low pressure. And a very efficient microorganism, and that's really where we get some of the cost efficiencies. Really, there's a number of ways of making renewable energy, renewable biofuels, but you really need to do it in a way that the consumer wins at the pump. And that's where when you really compare our production costs, Coscata's approach using a biological approach on the back end really lets us have some efficiencies using that low temperature, low pressure gasification, not having to buy expensive catalysts, and they regenerate themselves. I mean, they're a bacteria that continue to grow and produce ethanol.
Let's talk about the biological end of it for a second, the bacteria involved. I did some work in microbiology as a graduate
Fantastic.
And so I know that field fairly well, and I'm curious about how you maintain your bugs. Are they dying off and you're replenishing them in the same solution, or are you having to bring in new batches, from time to time to replenish your soup, so to speak? How are you maintaining the bacteria end of it?
Well, it's really a true ecosystem. You've got, Cascada has a set of microorganisms. We have like five, if you will, racehorses. And two of them produce exclusively ethanol. We also have one or two that produce butanol if we decide to go into future biofuel markets. We've really got a lot of opportunities through this biological approach. But let's stick with the organism that primarily produces or only produces ethanol for right now. In this system, you're going to have some of the organisms who are in their growth stage. You know, they're very early, and they're growing biomass, if you will. They're growing cell mass. And they aren't producing a whole lot of ethanol in that first hour or two, if you will, that they're growing. Then they go into the work phase. You know, they become productive bugs, producing ethanol. And then you get a set of them, days, weeks, months. You know, there's a whole, it's a very, there's some of that that's proprietary, but, you know, some of them are on geriatrics, some of them are old, some of them are dying off, sloughing off, as you would call them, the cell mass is dying off. And what we do is, that's organic content as well. What we do is circle them back through a low-rate anaerobic digester. So these are anaerobic microorganisms living in the absence of oxygen, not genetically modified, so they're not harmful to animals or humans. Or what if these organisms get out? Well, they die in the presence of oxygen. So it's a truly anaerobic system with these microorganisms. As we continue to advance the organism, it really is like breeding racehorses or something. We continue to get better and better organisms, higher productivity rates of ethanol. We will introduce them to the plant, to the system. And then what would happen is you'd have the same plant with more ethanol being produced. Really an interesting approach in a biological system that you could introduce a new organism to the same system to have higher production rates of biofuels.
So in one particular system, do they pretty much self replicate and stay at a certain stasis level of concentration, or do you have an inflow and an outflow on the microorganism end of things?
We have a seed tank, but that's mostly just to keep fresh organisms coming in and new ampules are delivered. But you know what we're looking at is a complete system that self-generating. They form biofilms. Sounds like you're familiar with microorganisms. They're natural film formers, which means they form into colonies that prevent them from viruses, also known as phages, from forming. Really a robust system, tolerant to a lot more. They aren't finicky. These are actually very tolerant, very very robust microorganisms producing ethanol and a much easier biological process. And so you have essentially bugs forming into a film. On a membrane type material. We talked about this being you can either do it on membranes, you can do it on in different moving bed bioreactor type designs. And so we have a number of patented designs that allow us to really produce ethanol at the quantities we're talking about.
Another thing that I think of in a system where you're talking on the front end about gasification, I'm thinking heat. You talk microorganisms, I'm thinking, they're not going to be too resilient to heat. So are you're cooling down the gases before they hit the microorganisms.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful way of recovering energy. So what we have is the ability to put either high temperature, high pressure steam back out to a co-located partner, such as a pulp and paper mill. That would be wonderful for them. Or if you really don't have any reason to use it, you run it through a steam turbine. You generate electricity, and you're actually giving electricity back to the grid. So it could be a standalone facility actually putting power out You know, it's not only does it not take natural gas to run the process or power lines, it could be a net producer of electricity, is how interesting this approach is.
There's a number of companies out there. You know, we've got an index page of various waste-to-energy companies, and there's a whole slew of them who are working on that, producing syngas. You've got StarTech, you've got MagnaGas, or two that come to mind. And syngas is a product that comes out along with a, they've got a solid that comes out as well. It seems like, you know, they're very good at that end of things. Is the gasification end of things? And then what they do is with that process, they're generating electricity with some of the heat that they're producing in that gasification process, because you've got inflow, you've got the energy in the chemical bonds that are being broken in the combustion process, and they're harnessing that by capturing that heat and using it, whether it's to turn turbines or whatever, that, you know, some thermal to electric mechanisms. And you're then taking the syngas, which is the product, and you're turning it into ethanol. And how, in your business model, how much are you courting these companies that are producing syngas as saying, hey, you know, we're a potential marriage partner here where we can take that product and turn it into something even more useful?
I think it's a wonderful fit. Hopefully some of them have been listening to your show today. You know, the big companies doing waste to energy, including the ones you talked about, Covanta, and others. I mean, you've got the big guys like Waste Management and Allied and others who have the waste as well and are saying, what do we do with this material that we have, that we could turn into not energy, so instead of waste to energy, you have then the choice on the back end. Sort of almost like a Lego block. Just like you explained it. Syngas is our, you know, is a product for them, and it is a raw material for us. We turn synthesis gas into a high-value liquid fuel, displacing oil globally. So what you have is an opportunity for someone to say, do I want to turn this waste into energy, power, or do I want to turn this waste into ethanol? And Coscata hopes to be, as you say, a wonderful fit, a wonderful partner. And we are courting them, as you would say, to partner with Coscata to produce this.
Just along the metaphorical lines, as I think about your system, it reminds me a lot of the digestive system in animals, humans, where you eat stuff and you've got bugs in your gut that converting it into other things, and of course one of the byproducts is gas. But
It's living systems are great. There's always something you breathe in. For them, it's the bugs. It's synthesis gas. For us, it's air. And we do have a couple ways of putting out liquids and other things. So the human body is a little more complex, but not a bad way of thinking of it. Is we breathe in air, they breathe in synthesis gas. We have a liquid outlet, and they have one too. But theirs is ethanol. Theirs is alcohol. But so a little more fun when your bugs make alcohol. So
somebody who wants to come and take a look at your technology, what do you have to show them right now?
What we have is a what would be called full circulating loop. We haven't built a full scale gasifier. The cost is prohibitive to do that, and what we want is more flexibility. What I want to be able to show is our microorganisms can take in synthesis gas derived from tires, from trash, from leftover sugar cane, from leftover corn stalks, from new energy crops. So we have what's called an autothermal reformer on the front end. Takes and it really creates the composition of that carbon monoxide hydrogen stream on the front end. And we've spent hundreds of thousands, millions as it might be, to really have a robust system on the front end to create the synthesis gas. We then have a full facility with the latest advancements in microbiology, advancing the organism. So probably one of the foremost anaerobic microbiology labs in the world. Even the Dow Chemical Company only has, we have one of three pieces of equipment in the world. The Dow Chemical Company has one of the others. I mean, we really have been blessed with investors, venture capital investors, who have said don't let hiring the best people or getting the best equipment prohibit you from really breaking into this industry and having a kind of a paradigm-shifting technology get out to market. So you're going to see a microbiology kind of lab. You'll also see what we call our four or five different bioreactor designs. That's simply the home where these bugs, these microorganisms, I use that term interchangeably, where these microorganisms live. It's called a bioreactor. So we have four or five different, patent-pending designs that we're experimenting with, as it might be, for the production of ethanol. And then, we put it all together and we have synthesis gas coming in, the strain-developed, strain-enhanced microorganisms in a bioreactor design with ethanol being separated off of it and getting, ethyl alcohol or ethanol out the back end. So we can show that the Coscata process works efficiently with the thermodynamics that are necessary to be a commercially scalable, commercially viable process.
The ethanol chemically is, what is it? There's an OH on it, the CH.
That's a great question, and I know someone knows it, and it's just slipped my mind. It's like, I thought it was a C6, H2O6 or something like that. It's got a C, an H, and an O in there.
Methane is one, ethanol is two carbon atoms, and then you've got the OH on there for the all. Now, on the output end, they're producing ethanol. Do you have to do any further treating of it? Do you have to separate anything out? Do you have to screen it in any way, or is it good to go once it comes out?
Now, that's the great part, is we don't have other byproducts like a Fischer-Tropsch chemical catalyst process that has butanol, hexanol, octanol, propanol, other mixed alcohols, if you will, that are natural coming out of a chemical catalyst. We produce only ethanol. And so when you separate it out, all we're really separating is ethanol and water. And we have a water recycle loop. Real good efficiencies, less than a gallon of processed water to get to a gallon of ethanol, because all we're really doing is separating alcohol from water based on solubility. And so we produce fuel-grade ethanol right at the back end of our plant.
And so let's talk about that separation of ethanol and water. Is that a very complicated process, or is that something you've got patents on, or is that something off the shelf that you grab somewhere else?
Some we've worked on co-patents, a company called MTR. We've also got other, it's based out of Menlo Park, California, but there's some others that we've worked with as well. Two real approaches on this. If you have a 3 or 4% alcohol stream, think of a light beer, is really what you have. 3 or 4% alcohol, maybe as high as 5% at some point, alcohol in a water stream. Two ways of handling this. Conventional distillation. That's been done on ethanol plants for hundreds of years. I don't know, as long as people have been drinking alcohol, I guess. Distilleries, distillation, that's very possible. That's technology known today. Pull it off the shelf. Coscata doesn't worry about it at all. The other approach would be what we have termed membrane separation, or a vapor permeation technology, separating this ethanol and water based on solubility in the gas form. And we've got some special approaches. Saves about 50% of the energy. You figure it requires one unit of energy to separate ethanol and water in a distillation method. This method would require less, actually, than half of that energy to do it based on a membrane, that separates ethanol and water based on its solubility, not based on heating it up and cooling it down, heating it up and cooling it down, which is what distillation is.
Okay, and that membrane separation, is this a continuous loop thing, or do you have one input and one output?
Yeah, a little bit water, water comes off that bottom end, then a water recycle, and then you've got ethanol goes through the membrane and essentially comes out as 90-plus percent alcohol, and then you may or may not. We've got some proprietary techniques that get it to 99.7-plus, which is what people term fuel-grade ethanol, what could go into your car. So, I mean, it's an approach which really gives us that flexibility to do the membrane separation that's based on ethanol having a different solubility than water.
So one of your byproducts is water?
We recirculate it back around. I mean, I guess you'd have to have a little bit of a waste. It would be like 100 people addition to a wastewater treatment plant. So most any city count could add 100 people is really what our wastewater process is.
In a commercial setting, once you've got this up and you're talking about a year from now, how many people would be involved in one plant, and what size of inflow are you talking about? Are you targeting 100 ton per day? What's your target?
Yeah, what you're looking at are, you know, if you're really going to make an impact, I mean, the Renewable Fuel Standard was signed to do 21 billion gallons of biofuels from non-food-based sources, a total of 36 billion gallons mandated of biofuels. And that's what the president signed in the 2007 Energy Security Act in December of 2007. To really hit 21 billion gallons, you're going to have to make a lot of plants. In fact, at 100 million gallons apiece, you're talking, you know, what, 210 facilities. So you really can't start with the 50 or 100, you know, a million gallon type facilities. We're looking at as much as 1,500 tons per day of dry material coming into a facility. Some of the facilities could be as big as 3,000 tons per day of material coming into a facility.
Is that something that can be sustained by, I mean, are you talking only large municipalities on that kind of size?
Well, that's the mix is you're going to start with trying to make the economics work to the advantage. I mean, obviously, if you're collecting, as many tons as you do at a waste facility, you're talking as many as sometimes 20,000 tons a day of waste goes into one collection. They call it a transfer station. But some waste places collect 20 tons a day, which is what, 10 times bigger than I'm talking about right now.
Mm-hmm.
Other times you're gonna want potentially a smaller facility integrated with industrial waste gases or some other process that you could probably scale it down. A 20, 30 million gallon facility would be acceptable.
So in your present engineering models, you're targeting 1,500 ton per day?
It's a nice number. I mean, that's we can scale down from that, but we can also go, I mean, that's the great part about using a biological approach is it's highly scalable in its approach. So,
well, let's talk about 100 or 1,500 ton a day facility. How many people would that employ? Would you be running it 24/7, or can you turn it off at night and go home? How does that work?
You'd run three shifts. I mean, you'd want this to be a true industrial facility for the production of biofuels. So you'd run three shifts, and you'd you would continue to produce ethanol. The great part about it is it's not real hard to run. What you need to make sure is that you're getting the material into that gasifier. And then the bugs do all the work in the middle. You just need to make sure you keep them happy and you give them their vitamins. And really, the ethanol loading off the back end and the feedstock handling on the front end, the material handling on the front end, are really where most of the people are employed. And I don't give an exact number just for competitive reasons, but we're going to do I'll give you a range of for scaling, 60 to 80 people, kind of to take to run 100-million-gallon-a-year plant. So it's really not massive numbers of people, which is good for the sense of what you're looking for in complexity. And so what you want to do is build one of these in every county, multiple of these facilities in states across the country. And really what you're doing then is putting the fuel where the people are. So you're getting fuel back into New York City, back into California, Texas, Florida, places where right now there's not a whole lot of corn growing and not a whole lot of chance to put biofuels on the market. And you're really expanding this process out to the industry, out to the, where the people are.
Right. Now, in terms of the, we're talking about, you know, a facility, the 1,500 tons a day, for example, 60, 80 people for a 100-million-gallon-per-year plant. What kind of capital costs are we talking about to build a facility like that?
So we'll stay with the 100 million gallons a year. What we've quoted publicly is $3 to $4 per gallon installed cost. So that means that that plant would have cost $300 to $400 million if it just was standalone out in the middle of nowhere. There's a lot of advantages to locating it, co-locating it with places where material handling is already there and where there may even be off-take handling of ethanol. And so there's ways to save on that, but we want to quote a number that is realistic and out there, and it will take investment dollars like $300 to $400 million to put a plant in operation.
Yeah, that's pretty good capital. What would be the return on investment?
Yeah, we haven't quite let those numbers out. I'll let you and the listeners do the math on dollar a gallon production cost. Because what really, really matters is what's ethanol going to sell for? And your crystal ball for the profit margin is just as good as mine. But we do know that there's good talk, and what we need to see is some action on producer credits for ethanol or for the ethanol market to expand for people to start distributing it. We don't have enough infrastructure out there. People have been holding back on putting ethanol pumps on the market. Now you have the UL listing for ethanol pumps, and hopefully this mandate to blend so many gallons of ethanol will start to lead to a real healthy economy of renewable energy and renewable biofuels.
What would you see as being your primary logjam right now?
Really, it'd be just putting together the right partnerships and getting the material collected. And I mean, the capital markets have been difficult, but what you've got to get is some real visionaries and thinkers, Fortune 100 type companies who right now are planning about the future and adding, you know, tens of billions of dollars in revenue per year to their company by entering this market. This isn't going to be a one-off approach. This is going to be this needs to be a global initiative to really reduce our dependence on oil.
Right. Have you had much inquiries internationally?
Yeah, we have. Been a lot of inquiries, especially in the Southeast Asia market, China and the Asian market especially. But you go down even into Australia, into South America, I mean Brazil, Colombia, Peru, Argentina, a lot of demand there. You've got Europe waking up and saying we want to do this ethanol from renewable sources, cellulosic sources. We don't want to do it from food sources. So Costata is a nice solution for that, you know, opportunity.
Are you finding that the U.S. Market, the U.S. Culture is the most entrenched in terms of the old paradigm and not going into renewables yet compared to other nations?
Well, the U.S., I mean, it's, you know, in some ways we're the largest producer of biofuels in the world now. And Germany has been pretty aggressive with putting more, you know, ethanol and diesel and so forth on the market. But Brazil has been very aggressive. Sweden has been very aggressive. So if you want to look at economies and markets, which really are starting to become examples of instituting biofuels and the resolve that we need in the U.S. By our government to put this out there, look to Brazil, look to Sweden, look to some of those that have really done a great job.
What's your company type in terms of investment? Are you public, private? How's that work?
Private. Yeah, we're still a private company. We took a Series B round of financing closed earlier this year, and we continue to stay private at the current time. But look to all options for the future to continue to keep Coscala healthy.
Who would you see as being your and this may be a question you may not want to answer, but I'm curious what your close competitor is out there.
You know, I look at most of them as partners in an industry more than competitors. And there's really not a whole lot of companies in the world who are doing what Coscata is. These organisms are very hard to find. There's people doing what you're talking about, which is a chemical catalyst approach. Or there's people doing an enzymatic approach where they use enzymes to break down the stuff. And those names, the DOE has funded a number of them, whether it's Iogen or Abengoa or Poet Energy or so forth. Those are names people talk about doing enzymatic type approaches. There's really not a whole lot of talk about, the process we're using other than what Coscata is doing, which is getting a lot of excitement. I mean, people are very excited about this. Having the best of the input material flexibility on the front end with the simplicity of making ethanol, and exclusively ethanol, not a mixed alcohol, on the back end.
Let's talk 50 years in the future when we've reached market penetration with the technology. It's been optimized. It's been integrated everywhere where it's plausible. How much of the world's energy needs could this approach satisfy?
I think a lot of people have thrown the number out, 30%, solve 30% of the world's energy needs through biofuels. There's a lot of ways to do it, to have solar, to have wind, to have geothermal. I mean, there's a lot of approaches that could help to globally reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. But, Coscata hopes to be a big part of what they're looking at is 20% reduction in fuel usage by 2022. So in the next, 15 years, what we've got is a mandate, really, to reduce 20% of our fuel usage within the United States. And then you hear another number put out there, which is 30% by 2030. And that is, about 60 billion gallons of biofuels that people are really wanting to put on. And it's very doable, very, very doable, since you have a chance to...
There will be other energy sources come out as well. There, whether it's wind to the hydrogen or whether it's some new exotic magnet motor that sits in the trunk of your car and turns continuously to keep your batteries topped off. There's a lot of different other modalities that will be coming forth. But part of my question to you, when we say 50 years in the future and you've reached you've idealized, you've optimized and you've implemented everywhere where it's plausible, and we no longer are burying our trash, we're turning it into treasure, we're turning it into usable, we're recycling our trash into ethanol in your case. I'm just curious in that model, you've got an input of products that we buy from the store, we use them, and then we throw them away. How much, what kind of is the saturation point of the amount of energy that the waste stream could provide?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I was trying to state early on, is waste is only one of many, many streams. In fact, potentially one of the smaller at a full commercialization 50 years from now. call it 6 to 10 billion gallons of ethanol, of fuel, coming from a waste, municipal waste that you're thinking of landfills. But there are waste gases, industrial waste gases, which could be 20 or 25 billion gallons if you really could collect all those. You know, I don't know how much of that is realistic. So you don't want to ask people to throw away more trash so you can make more fuel. That's not the most efficient approach. What you're looking at doing is saving it going into landfills and having a true energy crop, having 20 tons, dry tons per acre coming off of an acre of land. That's where you really, and marginal land at that, places like North Dakota, the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, Oklahoma, places where there's not food being grown right now, but you could really grow some of these energy crops. It's a mindset of, you know, people like the waste to ethanol story, but it really, really has to take into account all these new energy crops being grown on land here in the United States and homegrown fuel.
And does that 30% number you gave through biofuels that you gave earlier, does that take that into account?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you get to 60 billion gallons, it's going to have a lot of different approaches, a lot of different materials. So anyone betting on one material, corn cobs or wheat straw, and if that was all we could turn into fuel, then we would be substantially short. There's a lot of 1 billion gallon kind of solutions. There are, you know, needs a multitude of these solutions to get to 60 billion gallons.
Also, when you talked about 30%, are you talking about the fuels, or are you talking about the entire energy spectrum, including electricity?
Most of us talking on fuels there. Right now we use about 140 billion gallons of fuel, and what you're looking at is by, you know, you continue to roll that out, you might get out to 160 or even 180 billion gallons of fuel being used in the U.S. So, I mean, you continue to need more fuel as you have more cars and more people. So when I talk about 60 billion gallons, I'm talking about on a base level of, you know, as much as maybe even 180 billion total. But what that allows you to do is really get control over not being held to getting oil from countries which don't really like us sometimes. So,
or big companies that don't necessarily have our interests at heart.
So, yeah, no, that's definitely an approach.
Talking about scalable, on the small end, do you envision that this could eventually be a neighborhood thing or even smaller than that? Could each house have its own digester?
No, not really. That'd be kind of a nice dream, but household gasifiers just don't work real well. You've got the collection infrastructure in place. You know, what you have is microbiology. You and I, as smart as we are on knowing a little bit about microbiology, probably still wouldn't want to be running one of these facilities. So
what would be the smallest plausible size?
You know, I don't want to throw a number out there just yet, but like I say, to really capture 60 billion gallons, you're going to need to do, start doing them in 40 and 50 million gallon a year chunks. You might get down to 20 or 25 million gallon a year chunks.
If you've got a small township and you're out in the boonies, you're not going to want to hire your...
20 million gallon a year facility, though, is probably very manageable for a lot of, if you will, out in the boonie kind of places. So.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We've come to the end of our segment here. We've been talking with Wes Boseland of Coscata. Is that coscata.com?
It is, C-O-S-K-A-T-A.com. And, yeah, I'm Wes Boseland. Appreciate getting to join you today. So,
thank you very much, and best of luck and success to you.
Hey, thank you very much for the time today.
You bet. Take care. Thank you.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.